Blog Talk Radio.
TJB Radio. Intriguing programs you want, information you need.
And with that lively theme, we welcome you to the Jeff Bushman Experience here on Blog Talk Radio or wherever else you're listening. Good afternoon if you're in my time zone. And a good evening wherever you are, or good morning if you're listening in the podcast version at that time of day. Thank you for joining us. As you may have gathered by now, I am Jeff Bushman, and you're not, of course. Today on the show, we're going to discuss part two of Writing for Money. We did part one, as you might have guessed, last week, but I also wanted to discuss the daylight savings time and retirement age. And that may all seem odd, but there really actually is a connection. And before we do that, let me invite you, if you would, to please go to Bushman Books, B-U-S-H-M-A-N books.blogspot.com. There you can see some things we've written over time, although nothing lately, frankly. But also, for one thing, you can see, and if you choose to buy, our books that we have listed as ebooks on Amazon.com, and you can get to those and basically get previews of the books on Amazon's page by going through that site. Again, that's bushmanbooks.blogspot.com. But even if you're not interested in my books, my writing, you're welcome to go ahead, and we would appreciate it. You're welcome to go to the banner at the top of that page to get to Amazon. If you don't buy anything from Amazon, it costs you nothing, and it also costs you nothing if you do buy something from Amazon. However, if you go through our page, then they will remunerate us a little bit, and that comes out of their pocket, not yours. So if you would be kind enough to do that, we would greatly appreciate it. If you would care to call into the program, assuming, of course, you're listening to live, otherwise it's pointless, the call-in number is area code 347, followed by 850-8702. Repeating 347-850-8702. I will not do like they do on all those idiotic commercials that you often hear, where they read the number serially five times. That's 347, and make you nuts. The theory behind that is if you repeat something five times, people will remember it. You'll only need to remember this for 1 second if you choose to call. We'll try to remember to mention the phone number again during the program, but one more time, 347-850-8702. We spoke about writing generally last week, and with the bent, if you will, towards writing for money, and we're going to cover more of that in just a minute. But I wanted to first mention one thing that we have all kind of experienced here where we are, less than in most places, at least in the United States. That's daylight saving time. Daylight saving time. I almost made the slip that lots of people do. It is not daylight savings. It is daylight saving. The idea was to save daylight, although we'll explain why that doesn't really work. And there is a connection between that and retirement age, the standard retirement age. Why does 65 stand as what I, for many places and traditionally in this country, 65 is the standard retirement age? Lower if you're a pilot, higher in teaching positions, and so forth. But anyway, let's get into it a little bit, and then we'll get back to the writing discourse. The daylight saving time began actually in most parts of this country around World War I. It was then extended at various places at various times. During World War II, there was a period during which there was double daylight savings time. That is, instead of springing ahead an hour, you spring ahead 2 hours. The purpose behind daylight saving, in theory, is so that you will have more sunlight during working hours, during waking hours, and less darkness. I guess that's obvious. And it actually doesn't work very much, except there's only one thing it really does, and it doesn't do that terribly well. It does save energy, and here's why. If, assume it gets dark under standard time at 6 o'clock, it then won't get, if you're in a daylight saving area, it won't get dark now until 7 o'clock, okay? and that means you will be awake, assuming you go to bed at the same time during daylight saving time and standard time. You will use the lights and electricity, well, you'll use television, I suppose, if you're into that sort of thing, but you'll use electric lights and so forth about an hour less, maybe somewhat less each evening, at least during the week, and therefore, with everybody doing that in your time zone, in theory, there will be some energy saved. And actually, that does save some energy, but it really is not a major, major big deal. And depending on the time of year or the portion of the daylight saving time season, it is actually a little bit dangerous, and the energy savings are somewhat offset by the fact that if you're getting up and moving around in the dark, and your kids are going to school to some degree in the dark, this is less safe, and you're probably turning on lights in your house in the morning. So I have to tell you, although I am one of those people who loves sunlight, it's one of two things I love, not counting people and dogs, I really, really, really like as much sunlight as possible. If it's cloudy out, I'm not having a good time, which is one of the reasons I don't live in Portland, but we do live in the Phoenix metro area. We, by the way, do not do daylight saving time here. So if you're in Arizona and you're listening to this in podcast version, we are live now until the end of daylight saving at 3:30 in the afternoon here in Arizona, 6:30 Eastern time, 3:30 Pacific. And in the mountain time that's not Arizona, 4:30. And by now, if you're not confused, there's something wrong, or you're not listening, or you're confused by someone else. But in any event, that's the situation. And it is now a tradition and a custom, and it's really hard to persuade legislators that we should not bother with daylight saving, particularly since wherever you are, the rest of the country is using it. It would have to be a congressional enactment, and even though it's really easy to get legislation through the current Congress, this is even in a more pliable and reliable Congress, that's not going to happen. It's just too tough to change. And if you don't do it like that, you'll end up being like Arizona. If you, let's pick a state, let's assume you're in Utah, although the likelihood of you living in Utah and listening to the show is pretty small, but let's say you live in Utah, and you are able to persuade your legislature to eliminate daylight saving time and be on standard time all year long, just like your neighbor Arizona. Well, the problem is that means during part of the year you're on the same time as Colorado, and during the other part of the year you're on the same time as California. Most places don't want to go through that level of confusion. By the way, we mentioned that the purpose of daylight saving was to save energy and provide more daylight to the day. It's ludicrous. The thing that provides more daylight to the day is the fact that we are approaching the summer solstice, and which is, for those of you who don't remember, the longest day of the year, meaning the most amount of daylight. The longest day of the year is actually when you have to take an exam, or maybe the day before you have to take an exam. The reality is that although some people have said over the years that daylight saving provides an extra hour of daylight to farmers, first, there aren't that many farmers around anymore as a percentage of the population. And even if there were, the reality is it doesn't give them a minute more of time, because farmers don't use a clock. I mean, they know how to tell time and everything, but they don't use a clock. They use the sun. They get up a little before sunrise, typically, and they quit work a little after sunrise. That's the ball game. And they don't bother looking at the clock for the purpose of determining when they should work. They look at the sun and see what's happening. That's basically that. So if you are one of those people who doesn't like daylight saving time, the truth of the matter is, you have a pretty good case. Okay. The retirement age. That is also tradition. Oh, that worked well. We're hearing a podcast in the background, which doesn't belong there. I'm sorry about that. So we'll get rid of that if I can. In any event, the retirement age is equally traditional. The way retirement age first came about is in pre I guess it was right around World War One, World War One Germany. The ruler of Germany was, they had a royal family, and the person who was what we might call a king was actually called the Kaiser, a word, by the way, which stems from the same root as Caesar, meaning Julius Caesar. Anyway, the Kaiser of Germany was Wilhelm. Kaiser Wilhelm looked at the German government and realized that all of his opposition were people who were just past the age of 65. So by royal decree, he issued an edict that said mandatory retirement age is now 65 years old. That got rid of all of his opposition. Rather clever. This was tried in a different way, by the way, by President Roosevelt when he tried to pack the Supreme Court to add a justice for each justice who was over 70. That worked equally poorly, but the retirement age stuck. And when we got around to creating a retirement age or an age by which you could receive Social Security, the U.S. government at that time, that was in 1933 or 34, I'm not sure which, I think it was 33, decreed that it should be 65. One of the reasons they chose an age that old is because relatively few people lived past 65. So the benefits that would have to be paid out were relatively small compared to the amounts of payments that were being taken in. So that's your story about retirement age. I believe pilots, commercial pilots, have to retire at age 60. And professors in most universities, I believe, now have a retirement age of 70, which is a problem in terms of getting younger teachers into the field, at least at the university level. Okay, let's talk about writing for money. Let me invite you once more, if you'd like to talk about something we've talked about thus far, or want to talk about something else related particularly to politics, the number is 347-850-8702. We talked about ways to get ideas last week, and we also talked about what you could write if you want to write for money. And now let's talk about getting published formally and informally. And let's talk about formally first, and when we talk about informally, I will try to remember to talk about the long tail, because this is an important idea for you to be aware of. If you want to get published by a commercial publisher, you have just written a book, and you want to get published by a commercial publisher, there's a couple of different places you can look to find something you need. And that the something you need is either a publisher or a literary agent. Most publishers, commercial publishers, will not even consider writing that comes in what they call over the transom. It comes in through the mail or UPS or whatever, if the writer is not represented by an agent. There's a reason for that, and the reason is they don't want a lot of junk. Okay, when they get something in the mail, they have no one has judged it before them, so they would rather not have people they have to spend a lot of money to hire. They do have people like this to go through what they call the slush pile. And so almost all commercial publishers, not all, but certainly all the bigger ones, will not consider your writing at all unless you're represented by an agent. So how do you find an agent and how do you find a publisher? In other words, you can ignore that advice about trying to get an agent and just go directly to the publisher, knowing that you're not going to get as warm a reception as you would if you went through an agent. There are two principal publications that will tell you how to find publishers and agents. You can find agents in this book too. One is a book which comes out every year called Writer's Market. It is published by the same folks who publish a magazine called Writer's Digest. Writer's Digest is a monthly designed to appeal to and provide information to professional writers or would-be professional writers. It's actually a pretty good magazine, although I haven't looked at it in probably 3 years, maybe more. And Writer's Market is a book which lists markets for writers. Although Writer's Digest, the monthly magazine, does some of that, each year's Writer's Digest collects that information so that you can access it. Writer's Digest and Writer's Market also have, or did have, I assume they still do, a database that you can access online, although you have to pay some money for an annual subscription. When you do that, pardon me, when you do that, you get to access that database, which is useful, and here's why. Let's assume you have written a book on the history of oil and big oil in America. Well, you don't want to send that book to a publisher who primarily publishes books on knitting. The knitting books may be very interesting, and the oil book may be very interesting, but the company and publishers that publish books on knitting aren't going to be interested in your book on oil. You're wasting postage, you're wasting your time, you're wasting the publisher's time. So Writer's Market, and there's another book which is a competitor of theirs called The Literary Marketplace, in both cases will give you ideas of what kind of books different publishers will publish. And we mentioned agents. The agents will also list the kind of books they like to represent. Same thing. If you have an agent who primarily represents people who write books about raising dogs and about life with dogs and so on and so forth, again, you don't want to send him or her your book on the history of big oil in the United States. It's a waste of everybody's time. So that book, or I should say those books, help you home in. And by the way, I did not say hone in, H-O-N-E. It's H-O-M-E, home in on the right agents or the right publishers. And again, all of the things being equal, you want to go to an agent. Why do you want to go to an agent? Well, as we mentioned a moment ago, an agent performs a task. An agent earns money. They charge you something between 10% and 15% of what you receive from the publisher. For the price, as a price of representing your book and trying to get a publisher for it. Frankly, my opinion is, if an agent is successful, they're well worth the money. That is, if they're successful on your book. Because without the agent, you would stand a much lower chance of finding a publisher. So if you've written something and you want to form a publisher, get an agent. Okay? Now, getting an agent isn't easy, and one of the reasons getting an agent is not easy is the same reason publishers prefer to get agents' submissions rather than your submissions or my submissions. And that is that the agent, because they're going to spend time without getting any money, want to only represent books they think have a chance to sell. So they perform a kind of editing or screening function for the publishers. And what happens then is if an agent goes to Random House or Scribner's or any of the other big publishers, they are in effect saying, I have read through this book and it looks damn good, or book proposal. This is something you should look at, Mr. Random House or Ms. Scribner's. And that way the publishers know generally, especially if they've worked with that agent before, that this is something that might, in fact, be worth their time. That's it. That's how you do it. So, and by the way, you don't write your, as a rule, you don't write your whole book and then go find an agent. What you do is you write a chapter, two, three chapters, whatever, and a proposal about the book. And you can find out in Writer's Market, and you can find out online how to write a book proposal. So write the book proposal, write the first few chapters or three sample chapters in the book, submit all of that to an agent that you locate in Writer's Market or Literary Marketplace, and you're off to the races. That said, getting formally published is extraordinarily difficult. There are lots of reasons for that, but among them is that the marketplace is so limited. Yes, we know there are lots of books that are selling in your local Barnes & Noble, and are selling on Kindle as ebooks, but in terms of the formal printed publications, it is tough. There are so many books competing for readers' attention that publishers only want to spend money at all on books that they are convinced are going to sell. So particularly if you've got something that's really unusual, you're going to have a very tough time selling it to a formal publisher, even with an agent. Okay, before we talk about self-publishing, which is publishing as an ebook, which is a form of self-publishing, let me talk to you about what vanity publishing is. Vanity publishing is a little different. Vanity publishing means you go to someone and you print the book. You print 1,000 copies, you print 10,000 copies. You now have a hardcover book with your name on it as the author. So if you're writing The History of Knitting by you, let's assume your name is Jaime Gesundheit. So you have The History of Knitting by Jaime Gesundheit, and man, that looks good. Having your name in print, I will tell you, is a thrill. I mentioned credentials last week, and I hate to do it again only because it sounds like bragging, but I'm not doing that. I write a monthly column for a local lifestyle magazine here in Arizona. I have written three books that are up on Amazon as ebooks. My books sell every month. I get paid for the magazine column, and I've been paid for writing over the years. While I may not be the world's foremost expert on anything, I do know a little about what I'm talking about here. And so if you don't find it too boring, you might find the advice worthwhile. But vanity publishing is what I've just described. You don't want to do vanity publishing, typically, because you're spending a lot of money and you're getting books that you now then have to go sell. And selling hardcover books by going around to bookstores is almost impossible. There are some other ways you can sell books that you have in your possession, but it's truly not easy. It's a very rough way to go, and you'll be spending a lot of money that that you could be using better elsewhere. So the other choice, and there are some other things you can do online, but I think the best choice is to publish as an ebook. And there, while there are other avenues you can go through, I'm only going to talk briefly about Amazon Kindle. It costs you nothing to place your book up on Amazon's site, and people will be able to read your book with a Kindle reader, but they don't have to. They can read your book by downloading an application on their computer or their smartphone. It's the Kindle app. It's free, unlike the Kindle reader, which starts, I think, at $100. They can download the app on their smartphone or on their computer or both, and by doing so, they can read all the Kindle books that exist. By pricing your books at $2.99, you will get 30% of that every time someone buys a book. So it's about a buck, a little less than a buck. And that may sound small, but I will tell you it's significantly larger than the royalty you get on your books that sell in a bookstore. That's much less. And that's understandable, too, because the publisher has to spend money on printing and all that. You're not printing, you're producing your book in digits, in digital format, I should say. So if you look at the three books that I've got up there, one is called The Mobile Millionaire, which is a book on mobile home investment. Yes, I am hawking books. Anyway, besides that, I've also got a mystery novel called Bobby's Been Shot, and finally a book that is a compilation of my columns in Scottsdale Health Magazine, Cover Up the Kitty's Ears. The book is called Amusing Sex, Funny Sex. But the books sell. I'm not telling you that Stephen King needs to worry about me, but the books sell every month. I get money from Amazon every month from my books. You can do that too, unless your books are terrible, and maybe even then. And what you do is you write the book. You can go to Google how to format books for Kindle. It's actually fairly easy. Do your editing. If you're not accustomed to being a writer and you don't have anybody around you who is, it actually might pay to pay a professional editor to do that. There are editors out there. But if not, if you don't want to do that, you can have someone you know read it, preferably someone who has some knowledge of English, assuming you're writing the book in English, or whatever language you're writing the book in. It's a very useful task, and it's worth paying for to have someone edit your book. Otherwise, if it's in really lousy English and poorly punctuated and all of that, you will have a few sales, but you'll have no positive word of mouth because no one's going to recommend your book that was so hard to read. Okay, but you can do this. You actually have the capability of doing it. And let me talk briefly about the long tail. And I'm not referring to your local rat. What I'm referring to is a concept that was created by Chris Anderson, who used to be publisher or editor of Wired magazine. And what he was talking about is this. If you publish a formal book, a printed book, that goes into the bookstores, if it's not a bestseller, it will be on the remainder shelf before very long, on the remainder table, and after a while it'll be sent back to the publisher because they're not going to keep a book around that's not selling. You may have the world's greatest book, but that doesn't mean it's going to sell well. It's just reality, sorry. So please be aware of that. But if you have a book up on Amazon as a Kindle book, as an ebook, it can stay there forever. And unless the thing has become dated because of changes in a market or changes in the environment, who knows? Whatever. In other words, if you were to write a book on the coming cold wave as a result of environmental damage, when in fact the temperature is warming, that might be a little bit outdated. That actually is a theory that some scientists used to have. And yes, I do believe in climate change and global warming. But the fact is that if you wrote a book on something that's not really accepted as broad scientific knowledge, and you were claiming to be a science book, then that might not sell after a time. But if you have a book up using the example of the mystery novel, any fiction really, or a guide to investment, that kind of thing is always going to be useful out there because of the fact that it's in digital format. It doesn't have to take up shelf space in a bookstore. It can stay there for a long time. So you may sell a bunch of books right now, and over time you will sell a lot of books. The publishing tail is quite long. So the advantage to doing an ebook, besides the fact you don't have to deal with agents, you don't have to deal with publishers, you may need to find a way to publicize your book. And if you do want to publicize your book after you've got it up there, contact us at tjbradio@gmail.com. Again, that's tjbradio@gmail.com, and we'll set up an interview. But that said, if you can find a way to publicize your book beyond your family, you will sell books because there are people interested. And even if you don't, you'll probably sell books. People will find you. Don't ask me why. And I'm not talking about your book. But people find these books because they are doing a search. And if your book happens to come up in the search, you will sell books. That's basically it. The other advice I would give you if you're going to do that is try to create your book. I probably shouldn't say this. Probably try to create your book with a word at the beginning of the title that is not the word like the word a romp in the park or whatever you're going to call it, but a book title that begins with the letter A. Because when someone is looking for books about your subject, let's assume your subject is creating lovely file folders, one of the things you may want to do is something like American file folders, or pick another phrase, you know, acknowledging the beauty of file folders, whatever it is. You can tell what I have in my office here. But something that starts with letter A, because when someone looks up file folders, books on file folders, and you know there are multitudes of books like that, when someone looks up a book on your subject, the books that start with A will appear first. I understand you probably anticipated what I was going to say, but I wanted to complete the thought. So that's an important idea in terms of being able to sell more books. That's what you'll find is the case. You also, by the way, when you write the book, you want to put something in the book about a way to reach you by email. I am happy to tell you I've had some really nice conversations by email and occasionally on the phone with folks who have read one of my books and have then contacted me. And it's just another way to reach out there and a way to improve your fan base or fan club. Another way you may want to do it is by starting a program on a station like blogtalkradio.com, because that will allow you as well to publicize your book. Did I give away one of my secrets? Yes, I did. Okay, we've got about a minute and a half left now. I did that right before I got the notice in my ear that we have 90 seconds left. That was pretty slick. Anyway, I hope you have found that information that we've given you over the last 2 weeks useful. Today, by the way, is March the 8th. We will next be on March the 15th, same time if you want to listen live. That's 6:30 Eastern Time. And we're still looking at trying to create another show later on a Thursday, and we'll be talking about that and interviews at that time. In any event, please join us next week. If you're listening on podcast, join us live. We broadcast live, as said, on Sunday afternoons at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. In the meantime, though you're going away, please don't go away mad, and here is our lovely theme. We'll see you next week.